From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Laurette Folk, whose new novel is The End of Aphrodite, published by Bordighera Press. Laurette Folk's fiction, essays, and poems have been published in Upstreet, Waxwing, Gravel, Flash Fiction Magazine, Mom Egg Review, Pacific Review, Boston Globe Magazine, and Best Small Fictions 2019. Her novel, A Portal to Vibrancy, was published by Big Table in June 2014 and won the Independent Press Award for New Adult Fiction. Totem Beasts, her collection of poetry and flash fiction, was published by Big Table in May 2017. She's a graduate of the Vermont College MFA in Writing program. Here's a quote from Carla Panciera, author of Beloved Stories, winner of the Grace Paley Prize in Short Fiction from the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. The End of Aphrodite explores the relationship between artist and muse, between the subjects of myths and the keepers of them. This is a beautifully rendered work narrated by a collection of characters whose faith is inspired by the beauty of art, the power of the ocean, the remnants of ancient religions, and the many mutations of love. When the unimaginable occurs and those beliefs are tested, Laurette Folk challenges us all to wonder who will be charged with remembering us. What sense of adoration or guilt or duty preserves in survivors the stories that need to be saved? My interview with Laurette Folk begins with my first question for her. I hope you enjoy our conversation. So first of all, I wanted to say how much I loved the opening of this book, and I loved the first line, which is, Etta was the silhouette truckers had on the flaps over their tires. That made me go, what? What? I loved that line. And then the whole paragraph just goes on to fully draw me in. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how the book started for you. I know you worked on it in your MFA program because you thank your advisors. So this book was a while in coming.
Yes, my God, 15 years ago, I started this book. Okay. And, you know, I started it, I guess, because I had to start a book.
Right.
And so if I had to start a book, I went with, you know, what I knew. And what I knew was my family. And especially my Aunt Loretta, who was a very unique person. And her life was cut short from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
She died when she was 39.
Oh, wow.
And I was very close to her. So her death made an impact upon me. And she struggled. She struggled. And at that point, when I was in the MFA program, I had an intimate sense of her struggles because I was struggling too,
mm-hmm.
Especially with relationships. She was divorced and in an Italian American family, that is, you know, you're shunned because of that. You're also pitied because of that. And we watched her suffer through this. And I mean, she eventually found someone and had a child and then was sort of taken away. So her whole life was something that I felt I needed to explore,
mm-hmm.
at the time. Her relationship with my mom was complicated. She, you know, her life was difficult, and my mom's was the way it should be in an Italian-American family. She got married. She had kids.
Okay.
She was very stable. She was a good mom. So the dynamic between the two I thought was really interesting,
mm-hmm.
and I think I started there. But as I wrote the novel, Etta changed.
Okay.
The character Etta, who was based on my Aunt Loretta, she changed. She became less the victim and more the goddess. She became like Aphrodite. She became the sex symbol. She became powerful in that way.
Uh-huh.
But still a searcher, still a seeker, still looking for love and not finding it. And I think I got this idea from Patty Dan's novel Mermaids.
Okay.
I watched the movie and I was just really struck by Cher's character and how like uninhibited she was. And I really liked the juxtaposition of the Cher character with the Winona Ryder character, the pious young girl who's, you know, on a different path entirely, and these two are thrown together. And I think that influenced the Etta-Samantha relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Samantha is Mira's daughter, who becomes close to Etta and who's also very pious and tries to reconcile her sexuality with Catholicism, you know, like, Patty Dan's novel was a big influence on this book.
Now, the comment you just made about Samantha's personality, it just reminds me of a question I was going to ask, so I'm going to go there now, if I may. Do you mind if I just read a quick paragraph?
Oh, go right ahead, yeah.
Okay, so this is from Samantha's point of view. It's from fairly early in the book. It was painfully obvious I was a romantic when I attended my first school dance. I wore a white shirt with pearl buttons and a rose petal skirt with silk stockings. I went with my friend Evelyn, who wore a yellow skirt and white sandals and her long blonde hair in a bun secured with a daisy flower barrette. My mother took a picture of us in front of the lamppost on the front lawn just before the sun went down. With our bright clothing, we appeared holy in the darkening grass. That paragraph is really representative of your beautiful prose. I just think that you write beautifully. But also, it made me think about the tie between romanticism and religion and the draw to religion. And I've never really thought about that before, but it is... Actually, I have thought about it. There was a movie that came out, a few years ago called Novitiate, and it was about the young women who became nuns in the time before Vatican II, and the whole romantic idea of marrying Jesus.
Marrying Christ, yes.
Right, you're right, right. Anyway, I thought about that a lot during your book, and I think it's a really interesting theme. So, do you want to talk about that link at all, the holy and the romantic?
You know, Samantha starts out as this pious, do-gooder.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very influenced by the Catholic Church. You know, she sees Yahweh as the patriarchal God, and she fears him, you know, like she will be struck down for swearing or giving the middle finger. At one point, it says she gives the ring finger instead because she was afraid of giving the middle finger, and that is how it is. So later on in life, I guess I saw that Christ could, you know, there were, you could see Christ as like the handsome savior. I don't think Samantha saw that, though. I don't think she saw the romanticism of the church. I think she felt the patriarchal power of the church and was intimidated by it, it sort of pushed her down the road of being good because she was afraid to be bad. And it was not until later on in the book and through Etta that she realized that she was a human being with desires and with ideas.
Right, definitely the characters grow and change in this book. And Samantha.
You know, and that influences her artistry. Also meeting Joan, who is very much a free spirit, influences Samantha to be a human being and to relish all of the passions of being a human being. But the church was not that way for her.
Now, this is, and you've mentioned Joan, we've talked about Edda, we've talked about Samantha, so I should just move into my question about how this is definitely a story of women, and it's told from a number of women, from the perspectives of a number of different women. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about that, and on building characters and differentiating voice and presence on the page when you're working all with women from, in some cases, a similar background.
Right. I was very conscious of making these voices sound differently. These had to be different women with different experiences and different ideas. Joan is sort of the Demeter figure. She takes on the Demeter role of, you know, mourning her daughter. Mm-hmm. She's different in that she's educated, whereas Edda and Mira are not. And she, you know, her mourning becomes everything. She sees her daughter at dawn, the daughter that she lost. She believes that she was abducted and killed, and what actually happens to Elise is something very different. So her voice is very different from Mira, who, you know, is a housewife and has her own desires and needs and wants. And Edda, who is completely different from Mira. That I was very conscious of that they could not sound alike.
Right.
They had to have different thoughts. They had to be different people.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there is a main character who's a man.
Yeah.
Michaelis. He doesn't show up until later in the book.
Right.
And I decided to create him because I wanted a surprise factor.
Yeah.
You know, I originally went into this book thinking, okay, this is going to be a woman novel. It's going to be empowerment of women. And then I thought, you know, I need a balance here. I need another voice that's male. And that's where Michaelis came from.
Yeah, and he shares a narrative perspective with a section that is Elise's. Later in the book. So I wanted to also talk about, you mentioned how Joan is mourning the disappearance of her daughter. And I wanted to know, why do you think as readers, so many readers find the theme of disappearance to be such a draw? What do you think that's about?
Oh, I think that's all about the mystery.
Yeah.
You know, as human beings, mystery terrifies and entices us.
Mm-hmm.
I know for me personally, I think about the people I've met in my life who have gone out of my life, and I dream about them, and I think my subconscious is trying to find answers. I mean, I'm just one of those people who is tortured by mystery, you know, and intrigued by it, too, at the same time. And so I wanted to put that into the book somehow, because Joan does not have an answer as to what happens to Elise. We do, as the readers. We know what happens to Elise, but she does not, and she has to live with that mystery. And I felt like that's where myth comes in. Like, myth can be an answer to the mystery.
Right.
The myth of Demeter and Persephone is the background of Joan and Elise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the myth of Aphrodite is the underlying, is the foundation to Edda.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like myth can give us answers to these mysteries.
I loved how I kind of got to know the characters and their background and their larger the larger sense of the family, as I read. And one, I just have this one tiny little example to share. But there's this moment where Samantha is with her mother and her Aunt Etta in Etta's house. And she says, "Is it haunted?" "Not that I know of," said my aunt. "So," my mother said, "what are your plans?" And it was like this little tiny moment that just slipped by, but it's like nobody thinks that's a weird question. And I loved that it was just sort of like you present everybody very much comfortably in who they are. And I don't know, that was just kind of fun.
Yeah, there's a whole background to that, you know, and you see that later in the book. Yeah. I mean, Mira wants Etta to be like her.
Right.
You know, she wants a sister that she can empathize with, and said she's got a sister who ran away to a hippie commune, sort of, in Vermont, as far as she knows, on her way to California, and who's in and out of all of these different relationships with men, and who has a child basically out of wedlock. And, you know, so she's really, she wants Etta to follow her path. She wants somebody to empathize with, and Etta just does not. So at some point, she just resigns herself to the fact that this is not going to be the case.
Right.
So, you know, she's trying to ask her, you know, here's Etta. She's not married to Patrick. She's living in his house. She just got divorced from Daniel. She's pregnant. And, you know, Mira wants to know, like, are you going to make this official?
Right.
And Etta's like, why do I need a piece of paper?
Right.
You know, once again, very free-spirited. And at this point, Mira's like, okay,
yeah,
that's whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a lot of writing that went into that. There was a lot of, there was stories that I cut, you
uh-huh.
know, that this was a really big book that I slimmed down. I must have cut 100 to 200 pages.
I was going to say, you know, for a book to take 15 years, it's really a credit to you as the author that it's that it weighs in at, I think, maybe less than 200 pages, because they do grow over time.
Yes, they do. But you have to keep your readers in mind.
Right.
You know, I think a small, powerful book is worth its weight in gold these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I went for intensity. I remember Doug Glover saying that every page should be intense, and I think that stuck with me.
Yeah.
And I cut a lot.
Yeah.
So maybe that sentence that you just read, that, you know, so what are your plans? That comes from a whole boatload of pages that I just cut.
Yeah.
You know, I figured, you know, I don't think I need them. I think
right.
I can do this without them.
And I think that what you did really well was you juxtaposed it with that sort of question of haunting. And, you know, so the reader thinks you're going one way, and then you get very, you know, Mira's very practical. And that juxtaposition made it pop out and made me notice it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the book takes place in a time period that covers like the 60s to the 80s. And I was going to ask why you chose that time period, but it sounds like it's based on a true time period for your family. But I wondered if you had to do any research on that time period, or on like hippie communes, or...
Oh, I mean, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I read Tom Wolfe's book,
uh-huh.
The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. I was just blown away by that book. So I read that to sort of prepare for the hippie chapter where Etta escapes with the hippies. And because I didn't, you know, I was born in 1970, so I had a clue, but I needed more information. So I felt like his book was really the place to go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I found interesting, just from the craft of writing again, your character Elise writes poetry. And I thought it must be an interesting, I actually, in a book that I wrote. I wrote songs that a character wrote, and it was an interesting exercise to, first of all, write a song, but secondly, write a song that would be something somebody else would write as opposed to me. So what was that like, writing Elise's poetry?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, when I first started writing in a journal, and mm-hmm. I think I was 12 years old, I just wrote poems.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they were kid poems, and they were terrible. But that's how I first came into this, is I really identified with poetry. You know, I had published a book of poetry, Totem Beast. That was published in 2016-17, I think. I went through this period when I was pregnant, actually, where I really felt like my brain changed.
Yeah.
And that's all I wanted to do, was write poetry. And I read a lot of Sexton, and I read Plath. And I was constantly reading poetry and writing poetry. And I published that book. So I felt like I could identify with Elise, because I brought that out in myself.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, that's how I went about doing that. I remember reading a book too, and I actually don't have it on my list. It was from a Vermont College graduate, and it was called Women with One Wing.
Hmm.
And I am so sorry, but I cannot remember the name of the poet's name. And I read that wonderful book, and that's what spawned the poems by Elise.
Oh, okay, wonderful. Well, while we're there, why don't you can you share what you've been reading lately that you might recommend to listeners?
Oh gosh, I have finally gone back to the motherland, Italy. You know, I started out in middle school and high school reading English writers and American writers and South American writers and Russian writers, and it wasn't until these past couple of years that I made it over to Italian writers. And I think that was mainly due to my relationship with IM Books.
Uh-huh.
Going to IM Books in the North End, I discovered Elena Ferrante. And Elena Ferrante is an Italian writer from mm-hmm. Naples. Three of my great-grandparents are from Naples. You know, My Brilliant Friend was mm-hmm. amazing. And then I just delved into her entire you know, all of her books.
Yeah.
And Troubling Love was, for me, a seminal book. It just is incredible. I read that book and I was like, wait, you can do this? A woman can do this, can write about these intensely personal, like, passionate sexual feelings? You know, laced with all this anger? Wait, you can do this? You know, so Troubling Love by Elena Ferrante was huge for me. I highly recommend that book. I went through all of Ferrante's books. I read Calvino, Cosmic Comics. That's also amazing. And now I'm reading Domenico Starnone. And it's funny because by the time I reached the Italian writers, I knew who I was as a writer. And I would read them, and I would recognize my own family and the way they were within these novels, within these literary novels, which was kind of shocking because I just assumed that the literary world and my own family were two very completely different spheres.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know, Laurette, that you have edited and worked on an online journal for many years. Is it a print journal as well, or is it mainly online?
It's online. I someday would like to put out a print edition. I'm just not at a place in my life right now where I can do that. The Compassion Anthology was an idea that had been brewing for a long time. I really like the idea of anthologies and different voices coming together under a theme. Mm-hmm. For years, I wondered, you know, what could that theme be? And I remember growing up reading A Portrait of the Artist as a young man when I was in high school and just being deeply affected by that book. It had many of the themes that were going on in my life, you know, struggling with being an artist, struggling with piety and the Catholic religion, and the fact that Stephen Dedalus thinks about becoming a priest and then becomes an artist was huge for me. And Joyce writing that book and me experiencing that empathy was really profound for me. And I felt like, you know, by putting that book out there and by me experiencing the empathy, it was a compassionate act mm-hmm. on part of Joyce. I mean, maybe ego was involved too, of course. But I think that that's what we as writers do. We commit these compassionate acts by allowing empathy to be had by other people who are alone, you know, who are going through things that they don't think anyone else will understand. They don't know, you know, because they're locked in their own heads. And I think that that it's a compassionate act. And I was looking for works that would embody that, you know, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. Even if it falls flat on its face, I'm just going to try.
Right.
And after 6 years, it's really taken off. And I was doing it biannually, or maybe semi-annually is a better way of putting it, twice a year. And then I just, you know, with my life the way it is, it's just too much. So I'll be doing it annually now. And I do it under certain themes, and it's had a great response. And it's mm-hmm. really, and I think it's a place where I can juxtapose literature with art, mm-hmm. which are the two sides to me, really, you know, being a visual artist as well.
Right.
I've recently got back into painting, and I've always done collage work. So this is my place where I can place those two side by side and have an equal impact. You know, a lot of literary magazines, they have art sort of to just decorate the literary magazine. It doesn't hold equal weight, but I wanted to have a magazine where it holds equal weight.
Oh, that's great. I did want to ask you if you have advice for writers who might be tackling themes of religion, either Catholicism or just generally religion, which can be so potentially overwhelming. So maybe advice for, you know, making it work within the scope of a novel.
Well, I would have to say that using free writing, where you get rid of the editor and where you get rid of the nun with the ruler who's going to hit you if you, and I did not go to Catholic school, but you know, that idea of that nun with the ruler is always in our heads, especially if you were born before, you know, 1980. You know, do away with that and just be honest and mm-hmm. free write, keep your pen moving and just, and reading somebody like Elena Ferrante before you do this sort of exercise, because she writes with brutal truth, she writes with brutal honesty, can sort of get you in the mood to do that sort of thing, or maybe even meditating beforehand. I like to do that. Mm-hmm. I meditate before I write, and sometimes I listen to Tibetan bowls because I think it's just the sound of the bowls can change your brain function.
Interesting.
And it can put you into that place, into a deeper place where you're writing directly from the subconscious, and the subconscious has no editor. the subconscious is raw truth.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you've got to condition yourself to go to that place. And then I think you'll have success.
Wonderful. That's great. That's great advice. I want to just mention again, the name of the novel is The End of Aphrodite, a novel by Laurette Folk and published by Bordighera Press. So, Laurette, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Sheila.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with the author, Laurette Folk. You can learn more about her work and about her online journal, The Compassion Anthology, at her website, laurettefolk.com. During our interview, Laurette mentioned working after meditation as a way to engage her creativity. Specifically, after having a particularly vivid dream, she plays Tibetan bowl audio and meditates in an effort to recapture the dream. Laurette says the bowl vibration is said to change how our consciousness works, drawing people into a deeper state. After that, she goes to her workspace and writes. This is the writing prompt that she suggests for us. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please tune in next time for another prompt or suggestion. As we live through this unique period in history in which the entire world is basically in isolation, I hope that you're able to read and to write. If possible, I hope you're able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, please let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Google Play, all the places where podcasts can be found, and also on writethebook.podbean.com. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay healthy. Have a great week.